KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. November 22nd marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Journalist Dean Owen collected interviews from notable civil rights leaders, White House staff, and others connected to Kennedy for his new book. The book is called November 22nd, 1963, Reflections on the Life, Assassination, and Legacy of John F. Kennedy. Owen spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 14th, 2013.
Thank you very much, and let me echo my appreciation for all of you coming out on a beautiful Saturday afternoon to join me. Do you all know what your legacy is going to be? How people are going to remember you when you're gone? That question came to my mind in December of 2010. I turned 55 years of age and started thinking about what I would want my legacy to be. What I want people to think about me or remember me for when I'm long gone. And I have a wonderful job. I work for an international Christian aid organization called World Vision. I work in communications. I've had the privilege to see the organization's work in about 20 countries. I've worked as a journalist. I've worked in public affairs. I still do freelance writing for the Los Angeles Times. But I decided to do something and think about this event that occurred when I was seven that prompted my interest in how the news media shape public opinion. And I had just read a book called The Kennedy Detail about the Secret Service agents on duty that day, and thought I should do something about this incredible event that occurred that was the catalyst for my career. So I made a list of 100 people I wanted to talk to about John Kennedy and picked up the phone and started calling. And I eventually did wind up speaking with and interviewing 100 people, not the original 100. Several I tried to get and couldn't. The number one person on my list was Fidel Castro. I thought he might have an interesting story. I tried for several months to track him down, even speaking on the phone to Che Guevara's widow in order to try to reach him. No dice. The other person who turned me down, who was number two on my list, was former President Bill Clinton. Since we've all seen the iconic image of a young Bill Clinton with Boy State shaking hands with John Kennedy in the Rose Garden, probably in 1962 or 63, was turned down three times by his communication staff. The number three person on my list I got, and I became close friends. Her name is Helen Thomas. She covered the White House for 10 presidents. I first met her in 1980 covering Jimmy Carter's reelection campaign. She, of course, was working for United Press International. I was one-third of the editorial staff of the Oakdale Leader, a tiny newspaper in a tiny town in the Central Valley of California. I was hired to be sports editor, had never written a sports story in my life, but loved journalism and wanted to work in this profession. So I called Helen in January of 2011. She obviously did not remember me, but she said she'd be happy to do an interview. That later led to a phone interview as well as a personal luncheon with her in her home, an apartment in Washington. Fascinating story, because the first thing you saw when you walked into Helen Thomas's apartment was a caricature drawing of her sitting down at an upright piano. And around the piano were the 10 presidents. Of course, she was directing them. It was a wonderful image. And then later, she agreed to write the foreword for the book. I'm very, very fortunate to have met her, to have known her. In fact, she died about 6 weeks ago, I think. In fact, she is one of now 10 people who have died since I interviewed them for the book. I would like to, so that led to lots of other interviews, as you'll see in the book. It's divided into different categories. People who worked in the White House or in his administration, civil rights leaders, family members, a few celebrities, elected officials, and then people who had interesting, poignant, funny meetings or encounters with John Kennedy. Those include, I think, the only person who ever lived who knew both John Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald. I'm going to read you a little bit more about her later in our presentation. Most people don't know that John Kennedy Jr. was born not breathing. And the man who saved his life was a second-year pediatric resident who happened to be in the delivering room because the doctor who delivered the child panicked. He gave me a very lengthy interview. And then finally, most people don't know, but the Kennedys had a second son who was born in August of 1963. He lived for 40 hours. He was born, I think, five or six weeks premature. And the doctor who worked on him for 30 of those 40 hours gave me his first ever interview. He had never spoken about his encounter with the child or with President Kennedy publicly before. So that was a wonderful experience for me. He's probably in his late 80s and lives near Boston. One of my favorite people who's in the book is actually here with us today. I'm pleased and honored to welcome Patricia Balarjan. Pat, please. Pat is a fourth-generation Seattle resident. She first met John Kennedy in the 1950s. She also served in the 1950s with former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt as her personal assistant and has worked with the United Nations Association Foundation in New York. So I'm going to ask Pat a few questions about her experience. Pat, tell us about the first time you met John Kennedy.
Thank you. Before I answer his question, I'd just like to say what a very, very positive and delightful experience has been to work with Dean Owen, and how much I admire how he put together a book when he was traveling all over the world and he and his family were so busy. But it has been a great pleasure, and certainly the book looks wonderful. I haven't read it all. I just got it yesterday. The first time I had a chance to visit with Senator Kennedy was in Washington, D.C. I had gone down to from New York, where I was working for Mrs. Roosevelt at the UN, and I had gone down to spend the weekend with a friend. And I'm sure the name Scoop Jackson is familiar to everybody here. And he had taken me to a breakfast and to the St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington that Sunday. There's an annual Red Mass, as they call it, for all the people in Congress right before Congress begins. And Senator Kennedy and Jacqueline Kennedy were there, and of course they were good friends of Senator Jackson's, but there wasn't an opportunity after the Mass with everybody leaving the cathedral to speak to them, even though we were very close, sitting close to them. So that afternoon, however, it was the tradition, and I'm sure some of you have heard about Scoop and their, in those days, the traditional touch football games on the green in Georgetown. So we went to that, and just prior to our arrival, Jack Kennedy and Robert Kennedy had arrived, and Senator Jackson introduced me to them, and then he and Scoop and Robert Kennedy went out to play in the game. But Jack Kennedy, first of all, he was dressed in a suit and tie, but mostly it's because he was on a cane with his very, very bad back. And so we visited for over an hour about a lot of things. And the thing I remember the most is that his tremendous sense of humor. I mean, we did talk about some serious things. It was, he asked me about what I was doing up at the UN and all. And of course, it was a time of strong isolationist forces in the U.S. So there were a lot of serious things to talk about, but he talked about a lot of very light things. And all I really remember is that during that hour or so, we laughed a lot. But towards the end of the hour, Jack Kennedy threw down his cane and went running out onto the field. I think he just couldn't stand not being part of the action. And so I thought, and they've quoted it, in effect, they've done it at the lead of my chapter, saying, if your back is that bad, in my head I'm saying this, if your back is that bad, how can you possibly be running out onto the field? But after 5 or 10 minutes, he was back and grabbing his cane and in obvious pain. And then it was later that year he had his serious surgery. So it was a wonderful opportunity to visit and get to know somebody before they became president. Thank you.
Pat, you last saw John Kennedy when he was in Seattle in November of 1961 to give the major speech, a major address, at the University of Washington. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Well, of course, it was enormously crowded, and I, sorry to say, I was way in the back. But Dean and I did select a paragraph out of his talk, which is rather interesting because we did this quite a, what, 6-8 months ago,
at least, at minimum.
And so I'm going to read it to you. With the exception of one word I may have to ask Dean to help me pronounce. I don't know why I always have trouble with it. But this is a quote, and I quote Jack Kennedy, or President Kennedy, excuse me. We must face We must face problems which do not lend themselves to easy or quick or permanent solutions. And we must face the fact that the United States is neither omnipotent nor omniscient.
Correct? Good enough. Very good.
I know what it means. That we are only 6% of the world's population, and that we cannot impose our will upon the other 94% of mankind, that we cannot right every wrong or reverse every adversity, and that, therefore, there cannot be an American solution to every world problem. Close quote. I don't really remember much else about the speech except that it was very, very well received, but I think that that is a very pertinent paragraph.
Powerful words, and as you said, Pat, pertinent for our world affairs, our situation in the world today. And then I also would like to ask a little bit about what you think, as I did of the other people who are in the book. How would you describe John Kennedy's legacy nearly 50 years after his death?
Well, I'm sure everybody in the room here has their own version of Jack Kennedy's legacy. But I was very young at the time, and certainly my generation, and I think many generations, were tremendously inspired to serve their country, and inspired by his inaugural speech, I think. There was a story I read once that his father had been so concerned because he'd given a very eloquent speech a couple of weeks before, and he thought, what does he have left to do on the inauguration day? But certainly that, ask not what you your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country, I think has resonated through many generations. And many of my friends went in the Peace Corps, and many of them went into all other kinds of service. And I know it's changed their lives and their perspectives. So although he launched, well, that's a good verb, isn't it, a much of the outer space program, and though he certainly had a very far-sighted foreign aid program, I think probably the Peace Corps for the citizens is probably his greatest legacy. And in the end of that, my little chapter, I do think that it had a dual effect. Not only it let people in many countries, and certainly many third world countries, realize what Americans really were like, and many of them, I know some friends who taught school in just little tiny dirt villages in Africa, so they really served. But I do think that the flip side is that they came home with a real understanding of the real world and of their culture and of the conditions, and it enlarged our populace with thoughtful and world citizens.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much, Pat. Watch your step.
Dean Owen, the author of November 22nd, 1963, Reflections on the Life, Assassination, and Legacy of John F. Kennedy. Owen spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 14th. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at kuowspeakers. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Dean Owen in a moment, 920-949-KUOW. Last week, socialist Shama Sawant was elected to the Seattle City Council in a surprising victory against 16-year incumbent Richard Conlon. How does a so-called outsider candidate make an impact as a newcomer, and what unique challenges do outsider candidates face? We're going to pose those questions to Seattle City Council member Nick Licata, who, when he was first elected, was considered by many to be a political outsider. It'll be in the noon hour tomorrow. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 30, mostly clear. Friday highs mid to upper 40s and sunny. Support for KUOW comes from GET, Washington's Guaranteed Education Tuition Program, helping parents plan and save for college with flexible options and a nationwide choice of colleges, backed by the state of Washington. Information and enrollment online at get.wa.gov. Support for KUOW comes from Westland Distillery, American single malt whiskey distilled, matured, and bottled in Seattle, Washington. Distillery tours available by appointment. Learn more at www.westlanddistillery.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. November 22nd, 1963, 12:30 p.m., Dallas, Texas. Three shots are fired, and President Kennedy is assassinated. The 50th anniversary of Kennedy's death is tomorrow, and journalist Dean Owen has a new book about the president. Owen interviewed civil rights leaders and White House staff to paint a new portrait of JFK. Owen spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 14th.
Just a few more comments about the book, and then we'll be happy to take some questions. I mentioned a few minutes before that one of the fascinating people in the book is Priscilla Johnson McMillan. I believe the only person who ever lived who knew both John Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald. She worked for Senator Kennedy after he became a senator in 1953 for a brief period of time, doing research for various speeches or various things that he was doing, then saw him socially throughout the 1950s until she moved to Moscow in 1958 to work as a journalist. One night, her boss came to her and said, "There's a young man here. He's 20, and he's a Marine, and he wants to defect. He won't talk to me, but because you're a woman, he might talk to you." His name was Lee Harvey Oswald. She interviewed him for 6 hours that night in his hotel room, and later filed a story about her encounter. This is a photocopy of her original copy of her piece that she mailed to her office in New York City for it to be published in several places, in several newspapers around the country. It was called the North American Newspaper Alliance. I want to read you a couple of brief excerpts from her article. It starts off with, "For 2 years now, I've been waiting to do this one thing, to dissolve my American citizenship and become a citizen of the Soviet Union." Close quote. Today, 20-year-old Lee Harvey Oswald of Fort Worth, Texas, is in Moscow. He hopes he's close to his goal. With his suit of charcoal gray flannel, dark tie, and tan cashmere sweater, Lee looks and sounds like Joe College, with a slight southern drawl, but his life hasn't been all that typical of a college boy. I'll follow up here. Even though Russian officials have warned him Soviet citizenship is not easy to obtain, Lee already refers to the Soviet government as, quote, "my government." But, says Lee, "even if I'm not accepted, on no account will I ever go back to the United States. I will remain here, if necessary, as a resident alien." One of the others that I enjoyed speaking with very much was former Senator Gary Hart from Colorado. And he saw John Kennedy a few times during the campaign of 1960. And just had a very interesting story about his later work in the Senate when they were sort of investigating various issues. And I want to read you a portion of that. Here we are. So he's on a Senate select panel to investigate the intelligence agencies of the United States government. And he's talking about one of their people whom they had as a witness, whose name was Richard Helms, who at that time was a lower-level senior person at the CIA and later became the head of the CIA. In a meeting, and this is a meeting in the Oval Office with President Kennedy, in the meeting, Helms said, "On my way out of the Oval Office in a planning session, the president asked me to stay behind, and I did. He said, 'Dick, I've been reading all these Ian Fleming books on 007, which Kennedy made famous. And he said, do we have a 007? Helms said he had to think for a while and responded, "Well, Mr. President, not in the way those books portray, but one of our principal agents has a lot of exciting stories to tell." And Kennedy said, "Bring him around. I'd like to meet him." His name was William Harvey. Harvey became famous for digging the tunnel from the West Berlin to East Berlin under the East Berlin phone exchange and tapping into Soviet conversations. When the Soviets found out about it, they got tipped off and sent a whole bunch of people down in the tunnel. Harvey was manning a machine gun at the other end, ready to kill them if they came over. Physically, however, he looked exactly the opposite of Sean Connery. So we, the members of the select committee, called Harvey in and asked him to tell us if he ever met Kennedy. He said yes, and we said, "Well, tell us the circumstances." He said, "Well, Dick Helms took me to the Oval Office, and we were waiting outside. The door was guarded by a Secret Service man. We waited for a few minutes, and Helms came over to me and whispered in my ear, 'Bill, you're not carrying a weapon, are you?' And Harvey responded back, 'Of course I am. I always carry a weapon.' Helms goes back to the Secret Service man and says, 'This man with me is one of our top agents in the agency, and he tells me he is armed.' The Secret Service agent turns pale and goes over to Harvey and said, 'Mr. Harvey, I'm sorry, you're not going to see the president with a weapon.' Harvey reaches under his arm, pulls out a .45 and a shoulder holster, and gives it to the Secret Service agent. So they sit down for 3 or 4 more minutes. Helmsen has a terrible idea. He went over and whispered to Harvey, 'Bill, you don't have another weapon, do you?' And Harvey responded back, 'Of course I do. I always have a backup weapon.' And the Secret Service guy took the Derringer off of Harvey's ankle holster. He was going in to see the president with 2 guns. One of my favorite stories. And then lastly, I'll share with you something from Bob Jackson. That may not sound familiar, but I'm willing to bet the mortgage that everyone in this room has seen the iconic Pulitzer Prize winning photograph of Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. I want to tell you the backstory as to how that photograph was taken. So finally the police said, "We're bringing him, Oswald, down in about 5 minutes. So you have 5 minutes to get into position." This is the Dallas police official speaking to the photographers and to the journalists. "We don't want anybody moving around when he appears. So I picked my spot, which gave me a clear shot. I pre-focused the camera to about 11 feet. I must have checked it 10 times. I expected it would be a pretty routine shot. It's a matter of the police escorting the prisoner. Except in this case, it was a little more historic. All of a sudden, someone, Jack Ruby, stepped out from the right, and the thought flashed into my mind, 'He's blocking my view.' At the same time, the car to take Oswald was backing up. It already should have been in place. I remember leaning against the fender at the time of it when the car stopped. I was leaning a bit to my left because the person, Jack Ruby, on the right was coming out. All of this, of course, was quick, instantaneous. He, Jack Ruby, took a few steps and bang. And I punched the shutter at the right time. It could not have come together any better. I guess I could not have planned it any better. It just happened, and I guess it was meant to be." This was a labor of love in my life because, as I say in the dedication, everyone has two legacies, a personal and a professional. I'm very blessed to have a wonderful wife of 30 years, two daughters, and an amazing son-in-law who are sitting to my left, who have been extraordinarily supportive and encouraging over the 2.5 years I worked on calling people, transcribing interviews, and seeking more people to contact. And so they are my more important of the two legacies. So thank you very much. Happy to take any questions you have. And again, I really want to thank you all for coming out today and hearing a little bit about my labor of love. So thank you.
Dean Owen, the author of November 22nd, 1963, Reflections on the Life, Assassination, and Legacy of John F. Kennedy. Owen spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 14th. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Dean Owen in a moment, 9:32, 94.9 KUOW. Steve Young, whose television writing credits include David Letterman and The Simpsons, talks about his book Everything's Coming Up Prophets, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. What are industrial musicals? I hadn't heard of them either, but from the 1950s to the 1980s, American corporations, big industrial ones, were in the habit of commissioning lavish Broadway-style musicals meant solely for the consumption of their employees as highlights of company conventions to educate and motivate the sales force to sell cars, airplanes, tractors, soda, and such. Some were terrible, some were brilliant. Most are now lost, but a few were recorded and handed out to convention attendees as souvenir vinyl records. Steve Young, on his book Everything's Coming Up Prophets, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals, tomorrow evening at 8. Lows around 30 tonight, mostly clear. For Friday, highs mid to upper 40s and sunny. Former rodeo rider, now Grammy and Oscar-winning singer-songwriter Ryan Bingham talks about his work and performs some of his tunes beginning at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from Arts West, presenting Little Women, the musical, based on the novel by Louisa May Alcott, a heartwarming tale of tears and laughter with the March Sisters, November 29th through December 29th. Tickets and information at artswest.org.
This is Melissa Block, host of All Things Considered from NPR News. If you make your tax-deductible donations at the close of this year, please consider giving to KUOW. The news coverage you rely on every day is possible thanks to the support of listeners who have become members. Please mail your gift today or make it online at kuow.org. And thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Dean Owen is a journalist and the author of November 22nd, 1963, Reflections on the Life, Assassination, and Legacy of John F. Kennedy. Owen spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 14th. Next, he takes questions from the audience. The first question is, did you meet Robert Caro? He's the author of a book called The Passage of Power, which punctured this audience member's image of JFK.
I know Robert Caro's book and did not get to speak with him. I did speak with other authors who have come out with books on Kennedy or who are about to, specifically Robert Dallek. And I had him on the phone, and I asked him some questions, and he said, your questions are really good. I'm going to save them for my book. Thank you very much. And he has a book coming out also. I'm not surprised, though, that your image of John Kennedy was punctured. One of the people who's in the book, who also was part of the slideshow, is Michael Medved, the syndicated radio host. And as you heard, he was a huge fan of John Kennedy and an even bigger fan of Robert Kennedy, and worked on Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign in 1960. He later did a book on presidents' chiefs of staff, and he interviewed Theodore Sorensen, Kennedy's chief of staff, sort of. He didn't have that title, but he essentially played that role and wrote most of Kennedy's speeches. But it was in that interview that his image of John Kennedy, Mr. Medved's, was also punctured, because he learned things like that Kennedy had a bad back, a severe back, and that was, of course, kept from the public, and as well as sort of other sort of the reality of John Kennedy versus the rhetoric of the John Kennedy that we all knew or we all were aware of from the White House. So, yes, I'm not surprised that your image was punctured. Thank you. Other questions? Yes. Sorry, the question was, have I spoken with Robert Dallek, the author of Robert Caro, I'm sorry, Passage of Power. Yes, Robert Caro's books. He's done several books on Lyndon Johnson, and his most recent one, of course, is the prior to and during and then after the assassination. I've read several of his books on Lyndon Johnson, and he's quite extraordinarily thorough and is a very, very gifted writer and researcher. I would love to meet him or hear him speak one day. Thank you. Yes?
What did you want this book to be, and what didn't you want this book to be?
Thank you. The question is, what did I want this book to be, and even maybe equally important, what did I not want the book to be? Well, as you might read in my preface, I intentionally did not ask anyone any questions about John Kennedy's sex life or assassination conspiracy theories, because I felt that, and still believe that, more than enough has been written about both. And I think that helped open some doors for some people to agree to sit down with me that might not have agreed, such as two of his nephews, Christopher Kennedy Lawford and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. What I wanted this to be was a compilation of interesting people, whether they're well-known or not so well-known, on the life, their encounters, the assassination of President Kennedy, and his legacy 50 years later. You heard on the slideshow one of my favorite interviewees, Phyllis Elkins. Phyllis Elkins was a waitress at Jimmy's Spaghetti House and Steak Diner in Huntington, West Virginia. And she was obviously very deeply touched when she met President Kennedy, pouring him coffee, although she says in the book she did not recall whether he gave a tip or not. And Kennedy is well known for never, ever carrying cash. Secret Service agents, his aides, et cetera, all had to borrow money, or all had to give him money and then get reimbursed from his assistant, from his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln. But when I interviewed Phyllis Elkins about a year and a half ago, she had just retired from 62 years working at that restaurant. And during the interview, as you may have had an allusion to during her comments, she still mourns for this man, and she actually was one of two people who broke down when I interviewed them, because she was so deeply touched by John Kennedy. So again, I wanted this to be interesting people's reflections and comments and observations, not a sort of tell-all or the new theory about who killed John Kennedy and what their motives were, et cetera, because again, more than enough has been written about those. And I really don't know, and I'm not sure anyone will ever know truly what happened at 12:30 in the afternoon in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd of 1963. I will add, though, that if you ever have a chance to read Vincent Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, I believe he did as much, if not more, research than the Warren Commission. The book is 1,000 pages. The endnotes are 1,000 pages on a CD inside the book. And he concludes that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Also, if you ever have the chance to go to Dallas, I was just recently there for the second time. I'm doing an article on the plans that Dallas has for the 50th anniversary for the Los Angeles Times. Please visit the sixth floor museum. It's an extraordinary place. And it really, even for those who have no recollection, who were born long after November 22nd, 1963, it's truly an amazing experience because you really get a sense of a bit of the culture, a bit of the times, and then what happened that day, literally from the morning, from the minute John Kennedy got up from his presidential suite in Fort Worth to the funeral over the next 2 or 3 days. It's well worth the admission fee. You're usually supposed to spend a couple hours there. The first time I went several years ago, I spent 4. So, other questions? Yes, sir, in the back.
Well, one of the signatures of Johnson's legacy, President Johnson, is the Great Society and the War on Poverty.
Yes.
Do you think that Kennedy would have enacted similar legislation if he had lived longer?
The question is, Lyndon Johnson, one of Lyndon Johnson's legacies is the Great Society, the War on Poverty. The gentleman has asked whether I believe John Kennedy would have engaged in that, would have taken on similar legislation or social programs here in this country. I don't know if he would have to the extent that Lyndon Johnson did. As many of you know, especially those who have read Robert Caro's books, Lyndon Johnson was born in a very deeply impoverished community in rural Texas and knew poverty personally. And I think it was a major political agenda of his during his time in both the House and the Senate before he became vice president to help address those kinds of issues. I know that John Kennedy was working on a huge tax reduction when he was assassinated. The legislation had already been put forward, and Johnson got it passed, I believe, sometime in 1964. So my answer in general is I don't think so, but he certainly was moved by the civil rights effort, and as you heard Julian Bond speak, his opinion of civil rights changed over the course of his presidency. He had rarely, if ever, met any poor people in the United States prior to becoming president. He had lived, as we all know, a very affluent life and lifestyle. We'll never know. I do believe, though, that from what I've read and what I've researched and what some of the people in the book have said, that it's highly unlikely United States would have gotten engaged to the extent that it did in Vietnam. And I think that is, of course, Lyndon Johnson's other major legacy and a tragic one at that. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Can you talk about how you first learned about
yes. The question is whether I remember where I was and what I was doing when I first heard the tragic news, and did I also ask that of other people who are in the book? The answer is yes and yes. I say in the preface, I was in Mrs. Gurley's second grade class at Burbank Elementary School in Hayward, California, and it was a rainy day. I remember it vividly, and the older sister of a girl in my class, and she had a crush on me, by the way. The older sister came to the door of the classroom and said, the president has been shot. And I didn't believe her. I said, oh, come on. It's not true. Later we learned it was true. I went home. My home was across the street from the elementary school and was like Tom Brokaw mentioned. I was glued to the television, read everything I possibly could over the next 5 days. It had a dramatic effect on my life. In fact, the photo on the inside back flap of me, which was taken by my son-in-law, Josh, it is me holding the actual newspaper I read that day, the Oakland Tribune. I kept it. I've had it for 50 years. Yes, it was. I remember it vividly. And some of the other people who are in the book, I asked that as well. And one I think you would like hearing. It's of our former vice president, Walter Mondale. And let me read you a portion of it. Mondale was John Kennedy's chair for his reelection campaign for the state of Minnesota, planning for 1964. At that time, Mondale was the attorney general of Minnesota. On November 22nd, I was serving as Minnesota's attorney general and sitting in my office in the state capitol with Nick Coleman, a leader in the state legislature and an old friend. I agreed to be Kinney's re-election campaign chair for the state. Nick and I were working on the campaign when the secretary came in and said, "I don't know how to say this, but I just heard the president's been shot. You'd better listen to the radio." We turned on the radio, and I heard the news that he was dead. It was one of the saddest moments of my life. The man we were working for was just gone. And let me read you just a little bit more here. He talks about the legislation when he became senator, etc. "There is still a horrible sense of loss nearly 50 years later. We were robbed." So, yes, I did ask that of virtually everyone I talked to because I wanted their reflections. I remember it vividly. We all remember where we were when we hear about sudden, dramatic, traumatic events. My wife and I remember John Kennedy. Our children will remember where they were when they heard the news about 9/11. Or it might be the killing of John Lennon or the death of Princess Diana. We all remember where we were when we heard about something sudden, dramatic, tragic. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
Besides the personal anecdotes from the individuals in the book, was there some insights about Kennedy and about his legacy that you learned through this process? Like if there were two or three kind of insights that you didn't know beforehand that you found particularly interesting?
Yes. Let me just speak briefly. One is from Harris Wofford. Harris Wofford was a senator for a brief period of time, I think 3 or 4 years, from Pennsylvania. But he was a special assistant to John Kennedy during the campaign of 1960 on civil rights, and later became the associate director of the Peace Corps, and then became later the director of the Peace Corps for its work in Africa. He wrote an outstanding book about his associations with Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy. And I learned some very interesting things from him. Let me read you just a brief portion. "The last thing that occurs to me, beyond charisma." Oh, I didn't mention the question, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. "Beyond any particular issue, Kennedy's great promise was going to be fulfilled at the time of his assassination, was his political skill. He was forever trying to see what would really work. He was genuinely balancing his best judgment on that, the way Lincoln did as to when to sign the Emancipation Proclamation and how far-reaching that proclamation should be. The main disappointment for me with Kennedy was the delay in the signing the executive order to end housing discrimination." And he goes on, "If he'd done it the right way," meaning that Kennedy had not waited, "it would have caused less trouble than all the delay. It was not the main issue people had on civil rights movement. The issue was going forward with a platform promise that he had espoused during the campaign, which was the most far-reaching Democratic platform, any party's platform, on civil rights. Where does Kennedy fit in the whole list of presidential rankings? Because he was killed after 1,000 days, rationally, he can't be at the top with Lincoln or our other great presidents. But he left an image of the kind of America that, at our best, we like to think of ourselves as, that which the world has yearned for and believed in. That has to do with hope, optimism, a can-do spirit. That image became more deeply etched in the political memory because of Robert Kennedy's transformation or change, or growth or transfiguration. That's a romantic way of putting it. The two of them together were a high point of American politics and the promise. If we had had 30 more years of John Kennedy, of Robert Kennedy, of Martin Luther King, who knows? No one knows. I like to think of those three figures as a whole. So, we've just heard a lot of news lately on recollections of the March on Washington, the civil rights movement led by several civil rights leaders. We just had the 50th anniversary on August 28th. After that march and the speeches, seven civil rights leaders went to the Oval Office to meet President Kennedy, including Martin Luther King. Of the seven, only one is still alive, and you might have heard him speaking about the issues and the times then. His name is John Lewis. He's a member of Congress from the state of Georgia, has been in Congress many, many years, is a major civil rights figure and still fighting for civil rights even today. So, hope that answers your question. Thank you, Josh. Any other questions? Yes, sir, in the back again.
Yeah, I've heard in the past that in the days leading up to the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, that members of Kennedy's staff were trying to talk David Russell and others out of holding the march.
Oh, yes.
It would, create too much conflict.
Correct.
And that, it just seems like he had a complicated relationship with the civil rights movement in the sense that, the civil rights movement was espousing some pretty radical economic equality critiques. And he had kind of like what Medvedev said, a very pro-business way of looking at things. So how do you, can you talk a little bit more about his relationship with the civil rights movement and how that...
Sure. Happy to. You're right. It was a bit of a strained relationship. And as you heard Julian Bond speak, his opinions evolved over time. And the images in 1963 of children and adults being fire hosed by law enforcement authorities in Birmingham, Alabama, really disgusted him and moved him. He also recognized the value of having Lyndon Johnson advise him on civil rights. One of the individuals who's in the book comments about a meeting that Kennedy's advisors had called with the president to talk about what's next on civil rights, when to introduce the legislation, et cetera, which I think was introduced in June of 63. And he looked around the room and said, "Where's the vice president?" And the aides sort of sheepishly looked to the right and to the left and said, "Well, he wasn't invited." And Kennedy said, "We're not holding the meeting until Lyndon Johnson arrives." Also, let me read briefly from some comments from Congressman Lewis that are in the book. I asked him, Kennedy and civil rights leaders, including Mr. Lewis, had met earlier that year, I think it was in June, on the civil rights legislation. And in Mr. Lewis's book, he writes how he was in the meeting but did not say anything. And one of the questions I asked him was, "Do you regret 50 years later of not speaking up?" Here's his response. "I did not have much to say during the meeting, and I do not regret not speaking up. I was the youngest person in the room. A. Phil Randolph, who was considerably older, was the dean of our leadership." Interesting, it was not Martin Luther King Jr., it was A. Philip Randolph. "He was our spokesperson. It was he who spoke up in his baritone voice, and as recall said, 'Mr. President, the black masses are restless.' And he went on to describe what was happening in America and what we were going and that we were going to do the march on Washington. When President Kennedy heard all that, you could tell from his body language that he was not pleased. He began rocking a little more vigorously in his rocking chair. He responded briskly and said something like, 'Mr. Randolph, if you bring all those people to Washington, won't there be violence and chaos and disorder?' And Mr. Randolph responded, "This will be a peaceful, orderly, nonviolent protest." The other said a few other words before we got up to leave, the president said, "We have problems. Man-made problems that must be solved by men and women of goodwill." John Kennedy listened. He listened very well. He listened intently. I just felt that my presence, being a young guy, that I didn't have to say much of anything. And after the meeting, we all went out on the lawn of the White House to talk to the press and said we had a productive and meaningful meeting with the President of the United States. So yes, his opinions of civil rights evolved, the question is, would the legislation that eventually passed, would it have been as far-reaching or as extensive as the legislation that Lyndon Johnson got through Congress? Another unanswered question of thousands of John Kennedy's legacy. We'll just never know. Thank you. Any other questions? Well, it's 3:15, and I really want to thank you all for coming. Thank Pat especially for making the trip out to speak with us today about her observations and insights into John Kennedy and Eleanor Roosevelt. Thank you.
Dean Owen, the author of November 22nd, 1963, Reflections on the Life, Assassination, and Legacy of John F. Kennedy. Owen spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 14th. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore, an independent bookseller offering a wide variety of gifts for holiday gift-giving in addition to books, including Husky gear, tech gadgets, art supplies, and more. Store locations and holiday hours are online at ubookstore.com. Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, committed to innovative ways to keep cows comfortable with bedding, cushioned walkways, misters, and nutritional and medical care. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com. 959 KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Nick Bond, Washington State climatologist at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean, has a weekend weather forecast tomorrow in the noon hour. Here's a preview. Nick says the unusual November dry spell will continue for at least the next 7 days. And one drawback to that dry spell is deteriorating air quality. Nick Bond with the weekend weather forecast tomorrow during the noon hour. The Weather Service says lows around 30 tonight, mostly clear, for Friday highs mid to upper 40s and sunny skies. 94.9 KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.